Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I hope you had a good time at the Printers Row Lit Fest with me and Jeff Carlin. There's a lot going on this week. The big report from about the FBI and whether they, you know, screwed up or not, and Comey and all that's coming out, and the North Korean summit. But you know what? I don't give two figs, because as we record this today, it's the last day I'm going to be at the Tribune Tower, and I've been having a lot of maudlin, sentimental thoughts, and then I feel like, I don't know, just getting some whiskey and drinking and have a proper wake. We had one the other night on the roof of the building. A lot of reporters were there. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to go because I had a column to write. And you know what's on my mind? They gave us this little orange box. Everyone got a little box for the move out of the tower. It's like a plastic crate. And they said, put all your stuff in there, all the stuff you're going to bring with you. So they came to check my office, and the Ron Fathers off the wall, and all the stuff, the, you know, all the daily stuff, and all the memories or memorabilia from years is gone. And they said, you didn't put anything in your box. And I said, no, because I didn't put anything in my box. What am I supposed to put in my box? My heart? You want my beating heart bloody and thumping in the box while you move me out of the Tribune Tower? If you think I was happy about the move, you've got another thing coming. And I wasn't happy about some of the commentary I've heard where it's just a building. It's really just a building. That's all it is, just a building. Well, when I'm dead, I hope God gives me a few years to haunt this place, because this place is full of the ghosts of journalism, okay? All the TV people have been coming over here asking me questions like, how does it feel, John? You know, and I give the usual lie, like, let's just bring some whiskey and we'll have a proper wake. I try to act like it doesn't bother me, but it bothers me. Here's another thing that bothers me, which hasn't been said. You know that the Tribune built this building for the Tribune, and because of business decisions and whatnot, we were split up. The Tribune was split into one company, and WGN, Tribune Broadcasting, Tribune Company, was split into another company. The genius of this, I think, was a guy named Peter Laguerre, who had, he was like coiffed, and he had skinny black jeans on, and he talked about journalism. And then he gives us all the debt. They take all the profit on the other side, and we get kicked out of our own building. And I've got one thing to say to this guy. A few years ago, when this genius was setting this thing up that ended up where we're out of our own building, they came up with an idea. They had, you know, they produced shows. And one of the shows was, I forget the name of it, but it was Smokin' Hot Witches were real, and they were in, you know, New England in the 1600s, and they were all supermodels, and they all had, I think, breast implants. And the plot of the story, I think, was these witches were real. You know, all the Salem witches that you thought were fake? No, these were real witches. And basically, they would have sex with you and take your soul or whatever. And then they came to the Tribune and said, we'd like to run an ad, a front page ad in the Tribune before we were split up with the witches. And the ad was Aspadia, which is on the outside of the paper. It's like half the paper wrapped around, and it's really, it's a big deal, and millions of people see it. This ad was of a hot witch in a tight fetching dress, which they didn't wear in the colonial times, and she was crucified on a cross, but hot. And you know what day this genius wanted to run the ad? Easter Sunday. Easter Sunday. And they came to me and said, what do you think, John? And I said, You're going to run this garbage on Easter Sunday? Do you know what this is? This is Chicago. You don't do that on Easter Sunday in Chicago with hot witches being crucified on Easter Sunday. And that's when I knew that we were separate from what they did. We were separate from that corporate suit nonsense. They didn't understand Chicago. They don't understand the people. They have no soul. So because they have no soul, we're out of the building. Now I'm looking down. This week I'll be looking down, if I really go, which I don't think I'm going to go for a while until I recover. But we'll be looking down at, from the Prudential building, and we'll look over at this building, and Jeff Carlin's going to be here still for a week or so until they have their move. So anyway, that's it from me on this, because we're going to walk around the building a little bit and take a maudlin look, and I'll probably start bawling like a baby like I did at Printers Row Lit Fest. We're also going to have Troy LaRaviere on the broadcast with us today. He's a candidate, one of the first to announce that he's going to run for mayor, former principal. And with me, as always, Jeff Carlin, WGN news producer par excellence and pie baker, Rokan Show with Anna De Volantis, and then, of course, Troy LaRaviere. And you know what this is? This is me getting punched in the stomach. The Chicago way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Jeff, did you notice the TV cameras coming around here today? Like vultures, like, you know, visiting a funeral. Like, hey, how do you feel?
All right.
How do you feel? They've been asking me that.
It's like a train crash.
Yeah, they've been asking me, how do you feel? Are you okay? How do you feel?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, I probably shouldn't have been talking, but I did because, you know, Larry and Robin, I love them. And
yeah.
Fox came over and they wanted to talk, and I almost wanted to ask the reporter, what have I written lately? You know, she's like, oh, I love you, Mr. Kiss. You're the best. And I'm like, I almost said, what did I write today? But I didn't, because I didn't want to be rude to her.
Yeah.
So I told her off camera. She goes, oh, I'm so glad you didn't ask me on camera.
Jeez.
And I'm like, what the hell am I even doing talking
dance,
to these
dance.
People? You know?
I know.
This is a time of grief and drinking, my friend.
Yeah. Well, if it sounds a little different this week, John and I are standing outside the Tribune Tower right now with a little handheld recorder, because as WGN, right off the WGN Walk of Fame, in fact, we're standing in front of what's now Howells and Hood, but at one point was, for a long time, was the entrance for WGN Radio.
Right.
And our sprawling street-level offices and studios. But we have no studios here in the tower. We have one working studio that really functions for what it needs, and everything's kind of ad hoc moved to our new facilities. So we're reserved to this little handheld mic, but I hope we can at least do a little bit of a reminiscing here about this beautiful building and historic building.
And in a few, we'll also be going up to my office, which is completely bare, nothing in there. You know, there's three chairs and a desk with, like, authentic, you know, laminated wood or whatever.
Right, you authentic know, laminate, real,
yeah, authentic.
100%
yeah.
Modular wood.
Right.
Yeah, it's something. I mean, I've obviously only been in this building a short time, you know, 4 years now, but it's one of those things, you know, it's because a kid growing up, iconic. I mean,
right.
I listened to WGN, I read the paper as a kid, you know, it was something you always saw, the photos or the image, the iconograph of the Tribune Tower and the logos for all these great, great institutions. And in your monologue, you made a great point that it does feel like at one point when the Tribune Media split from Tribune Publishing, that the soul of Tribune, of what the tower stands for, what the scrawlings in the lobby stand for, the soul of this building, the soul of the city, lived and resided within the publishing side of things. And once it was torn away, you still have the soul of the publishing here, and you feel like, okay, well, the soul of this building is still here.
But the soul is always going to be here. And the Tribune newspaper is the newspaper of Chicago, as you can tell. I tried to tell this to some of the TV people. I'm sure they cut it out. This is the newspaper that doesn't have Rahm's money guy running. It's, you know, it's not, doesn't have Rahm's money guy hiring the chairman and having nice editorials about Rahm. This is the real Chicago paper. And even though Tribune Company, these others took it over, Tribune Company moved us out, the soul is still here in the building. It's on the walls. It's in the cement. It's on the loading dock where I used to pace every day. And I'd see Jeff, and he'd be like, hey, what's up? Jeff's going to do the RoCon show, and I'm pacing, like, what am I going to write about? What am I going to write about?
Pitching columns.
What do you think of this? What do you think of that?
It's something, but I mean more of the soul that the publishing side of it. It's reporting. It's
journalism.
Journalism, and that's the soul of this building. I mean, all the interesting quotes, the people who are going to live here and come visit here, it's not going to have the same meaning to them. They're not going to be walking into their apartment at night from a long day of work and thinking about the First Amendment. Like, oh yeah, I hope I go home and I can take the First Amendment to heart. It's not going to be the same.
Will they walk under that carving, the quote from Lord Macaulay, that says, where there's a free press, the governors must live in constant awe of the governed. Will they care? I do. Because every day I walked through that door. Every day I looked up at this building and then looked up at that quote. And it reminded me what I was doing here, why I was here. And you know what? We don't need quotes to remind us, because we know what we're doing and we know what we're about. And so the soul of the paper is not in the stone. It's in the hearts and minds of the journalists who work at the Chicago Tribune. And I don't plan on leaving ever. I mean, I'll write till I'm, even when I'm dead, I'll still be writing a column four times a week. And a monologue for Chicago Week podcast.
The ghostwriting, yeah. It's something. I mean, it's just such a thing. I mean, the Wrigley Building, everyone sees, is obviously across the street from us now. And people say, oh, the Wrigley Building, a beautiful building. And it's, you know, it's great. It's a nice building. But there's no character to it, in the sense that the Tribune Tower was built as a beacon on the river, you know, and it's going to be such a different thing when I drive by in a few years, and it's, you know, you see someone,
condos
or some, you know, millennial engineer, tech engineer wandering in, you know, working out in one of the windows or something silly, and you're like, oh man, think of all the great thoughts that were thought in this building. And I'm sure the people who live here have some great thoughts of their own. But
one thing that people should know, if you're listening to this, every afternoon as a producer of WGN, Jeff comes out into the lobby and gets the guests. And I'm sure you've seen the guests reading
the great quotes
on the wall from Colonel Robert McCormick about what a newspaper is all about.
And, you know, the guests, that was always one of the things that was impressive. The guests always saw the lobby and thought to themselves, man, you know, to see the power of this is something else. And it changed their perspective always. You could feel it, that the power of the lobby and the power of the building impacts everybody who comes into it, and everybody who would join our show, who would come in for an editorial board. I mean, imagine coming in the lobby and you're running for office, and you see all the writing, all the different quotes about serving the people and being a conduit of the people's will, all those things.
And holding government at bay, which is a conservative view, because now many in my business think government, and journalists think government is good and it can be part of our lives and help us. Well, the Colonel Robert McCormick understood that you had to check it, because to keep your liberty, it was all about keeping the liberty of the people. And let's see how that rolls out.
So John and I have made our way into the lobby here of the Tribune Tower, and we're looking at all the amazing quotes and the wood and the beautiful essence of what the Tribune Tower is. And there's this striking map of North America, and it's a relief map, and it's amazing. I mean, it's got the probably almost two stories tall, and it's got this relief of the Rocky Mountains that goes from Central America all the way up to Alaska. And I'm told, the rumor is, that the material used to make the map is old dollar bills that were out of commission and shredded and used the material to make up this map. And John, I don't know if you've heard of that, or if that's...
I don't know that, but I would imagine that Colonel Robert McCormick not using...
Yeah.
He was like kind of like George Halas when it came to money. So I don't know if he did, but I love the story, and now I'm going to adopt it and believe it. You know what I see? When you walk into this, you see this huge lobby and granite walls. And in the walls are carved some of the most important quotations in our history about liberty and the freedom of the press. And one is, one of my favorites is the one right over the door to the WGN studio. The newspaper is an institution developed by modern civilization to present the news of the day, to foster commerce and industry, to inform and lead public opinion, and to furnish that check upon government which no constitution has ever been able to provide. Robert McCormick. That is just amazing.
It is.
And my favorite, if you look, when you come in the lobby, you can't get there because you have to go through the...
That's behind the security.
Behind the security. But the door that leads to the elevators that I take, above the door, where there's a free press, the governors must live in constant awe of the opinions of the governed. Lord Macaulay. And I just think that's probably the most simple. We have things from Madison, Milton, Brandeis, Richard Brinsley, Sheridan, and on and on. But that one from Lord Macaulay seems to be the most simple and direct of all. And yes, is this not a cathedral to the newspaper? This is the narthex. As you walk into the cathedral, it's like a narthex where the non-believers are first led to belief. And then you go through those doors and up into the newsroom, and you see the reporters who've been working so hard for so many years. And I remember when I was a copy boy here and running copy from the news reporters, taking carbon sheets from their typewriters, running them to the desks, national desk, foreign desk, city desk, and spiking those sheets onto spikes. Of course, there was no OSHA. There's no worry about if you tripped and poked your eye out, well, then too bad. You know, wake up.
You weren't meant to have an eye.
You weren't meant to have an eye. And that was it. And right when we were talking, Scott Stannis walked past.
Yeah, we just saw Scott Stannis and Kristen McQuarrie wandered through.
Yeah.
And it's that piece. I mean, that too, just that you would see so many people coming through here. And it's just this, like you said, cathedral, John. It's an incredible thing. And if anybody ever gets a chance, you've got to stop in and see the Tribune Tower, at least the lobby, because it's a majestic thing that really gives you the idea of what newspapers were meant to be.
It's the thing that newspapers are. The fly-by-night, internet, you know, bloggers who just throw their opinions out without facts, the political tribal drums of left and right that's all about savaging and deconstructing the Republic. Those are not newspapers. A newspaper is a place where people like me and all my colleagues write with their own name. And it's not Twitter where you hide behind a cartoon head like a cockroach and slander people. This is where you put your own name and credibility on the product. And in the last 20 years, we've been under assault by people who go for the trendy and go for the quick. But in the end, those who use their own name and put their own honor above all, I think are best served and can best serve the people. You know, and also on the side, you see the list of the soldiers. The Chicago Tribune has a list of all the people in a metal cast of all those who were soldiers and sailors and armed forces during the war.
Yeah, who worked for the WGNN Tribune.
Every one of them got their job back when they came back because the colonel demanded it. See, this guy was misunderstood. And yet, was he a liberal? No. But he loved the paper and the liberty promised in the Constitution. But thought, as I read that quote, that without a newspaper, without newspapers, there would be no check upon the government. And you know what? He's right. So let's go talk to Troy LaRaviere, and then at the end of all this, I feel like pouring out a couple stiff glasses of whiskey, and we'll just look up at the building and say goodbye. So here we are in the office, my office. It's empty. There's no books on the wall. The Ram Father's gone. The pictures of Daly and all the stupid crap that I had on the desks are gone. Everything's gone except for Troy LaRaviere, who is the first candidate to announce for mayor.
That's
in
right.
This city. Mr. LaRaviere, I'm pleased to have you here on the Chicago Way, and I've got to ask you a question. I think that given what the Tribune has reported in its Betrayed series, and given the fact that you are the president of the Principals Association, mm-hmm. longtime educator, I'm wondering if the Chicago Board of Education should resign, given what we found.
You won't get an argument from me on that. I mean, I think they should have resigned a long time ago. I think they should have resigned when, you know, they felt the need to close 50 schools. If you have to close 50 schools, it means you failed those schools. It means you couldn't get them up to par. It's your job to do that. I think they should have failed when they approved that $20 million contract for Barbara Bird Bennett, over the outraged voices of parents, and even one of their principals, the one you're talking to now. You know, I could see that corruption from the seat of a principal's seat, and you couldn't see it from your position as a board member or your position as mayor. You know, the list of things that the special education issues that just came up with, you have the state of Illinois State Board of Education, taking over a district's special education program because of just how much they delayed and denied, illegally delayed and denied services for special education students. And now, just a month or so later, you have this Tribune report showing that they failed to protect students in 7 different ways, in 3 different levels at CPS, 5 of which were under the direct control of the Board of Education. They failed to do proper background checks. They failed to exercise oversight. They failed to notify other districts when abusers left this district. And they failed to keep track. They failed to track abuse throughout the district overall. Those are the 4 things that at a board level, and even another, the 5th one at the board level is the law department, because the board has direct authority over the law department as well. And what they found that the law department engaged in was a conflict of interest where they investigated cases that they would then have to defend themselves from. It made absolutely no sense whatsoever.
It does make sense if you're talking about protecting the district, but it makes no sense if you're talking about protecting the children.
Absolutely. If you're trying to cover your own ass, it makes perfect sense to have that conflict of interest. And it's interesting, that law department, you know, as a principal, every summer I have to go through a 3-day workshop that's given by the law department. So for 7-8 years, I went through this workshop. And one of the main things that the law department covers is conflict of interest for principals. And so they talk about the things that you can't do as a principal that would, or you can't allow to happen in your school that would be a conflict of interest. You can't, if your local school council member is a vendor, they have to choose. They can't be both. If you have a staff person who's trying to get some friend of theirs or family member to get a paid tutoring position, that can't happen. It's a conflict of interest. So every summer I'm listening to scenarios that the law department gives us. Would this be a conflict of interest? Would this be a conflict of interest? So that we know what a conflict of interest at a school level is and we don't engage in that. All the while, they have this corrupt conflict of interest going on for decades in relationship to them investigating cases of suspected sexual abuse of children, and then using the information that they get from their own investigations to defend themselves and to malign the character of the people they were investigating. That is an inherent conflict of interest, yet they saw no problem with that. This is the law department. They should know this. So, they're telling us day in and day out, but they won't, you know, they're hypocrites.
So, again, to ask the question, just so I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, should the Board of Education resign as a result?
Yes, they should resign, but we know they won't. And so the question becomes, what do we do as a citizenry? What must we do? We elected the person that appointed these people. These people, the Board of Education is not there to do their own will. They're there to do the will of the mayor. And so if they resign, the same person who put them in is going to put other people in to accomplish the same agenda they were there for. This is not the Board of Education's issue. This is a mayor's office issue. These people have no expertise in education. These people don't, besides lining their own pockets every now and then with board money, they don't have an agenda for the district. It's the mayor that has an agenda. It's the mayor's agenda that is neglected in pursuit of the mayor's agenda. They've neglected their responsibility to defend these children from the abuse that they've suffered.
The policy, as I understood it in the past, years before, was if there's an allegation of abuse, it immediately goes to, not to the law department, immediately went to the Chicago Police Department and DCFS. And that is the policy. And they didn't, under, I don't know when, I think it's under Claypool or before, at least under the last few years of the Daley administration and into the Manuel administration, that policy changed. It was there for a reason, as you point out. Let the cops do the investigation. Let DCFS involve. Keep it out of the law department. But they held it together in this monstrous conflict that didn't protect the children. Why did they change that policy? And as an educator, when you first started as a principal, wasn't that indeed the policy? Notify the police? Notify the DCFS?
The policy has always been, you know, I've been an educator in CPS since 97. I took a six-year hiatus and came back in 2005. Since 98, and then I came back in 2005. And the policy has always been, you call DCFS. If there's an allegation of abuse, you call the Department of Children and Family Services. If there's anything else to be done, you consult it with the law department. So maybe if you think you need to call the police, you consult with the law department. But you don't consult with the law department when it comes to DCFS. There's no consultation. If there's an allegation, that's what you do. You know, I've had to do this many times as an educator. We had a teacher's assistant, a special education classroom assistant. A mother of a child said that the child told her something, and I frankly don't remember the details, but told her something that gave her some concern about whether or not her child was touched appropriately. Now, this was a person who had been in our school for over a decade, maybe two decades. Spotless record. The allegation made no sense given our experience with this person. Now, many principals, and maybe even human nature, if you think that this person whom you trust couldn't have possibly done this, that human nature might kick in to go and talk to him or go and talk to the kid and just to make sure you get his story straight before you call DCFS. But human nature is not what's supposed to be followed in that case. You're supposed to call DCFS. So I got on the phone before talking to him, before talking to the kid, before talking to a parent, and called DCFS. Because in the end, if you want this, if you want to make sure this person who you think has a good name continues to keep their good name, the best way to do it is to call DCFS so that an official body can investigate it and get to the bottom of it. And if there's nothing to it, they'll say there's nothing to it, and then he'll have that behind them, not you and your amateurish investigation, because that's what the Tribune showed, that many principals were trying to do their own investigations because they just couldn't believe that a particular employee did this thing. In this case, this particular person was cleared by DCFS and returned to work.
They believe Babyface? The guy called Babyface? They believe him? And Simeon?
So I'm not talking about him in particular. I'm talking about as a matter of policy. If you're a district and you know that you're asking people to do something that may or may not go against their instincts, then you train them to do it. And that's the failure of CPS. Correct. They have failed to train principals. They're training us about, they trained us about conflict of interest. They give us all these scenarios every year about the things they don't want us to do, the mistakes they don't want us to make. Not once in that training did they ever give us, that I can remember, a scenario involving the sexual abuse of children. Right? Not once. And so if it's important to you, you train people to do the thing you want them to do. They did not do that. In that particular case in Simeon, that one just seemed egregious. Like, they had warning after warning. That person should have never been there. Even after they got a warning, I think from the district, after a background check with a letter saying, do not let this person volunteer, they still let the person volunteer. There's no excuse for that, training or no training. You get a letter from the district saying, don't let this person volunteer, they need to be out. And so that person, I think they're gone from the district now, but that person should have been held accountable.
He's in prison, but...
No, I'm talking about the principal who ignored...
Yes.
I don't know if they're still in the district.
The thing people ask, I'm sure parents understand this. When you have a population of children, it's like the schools is like a city. It's like a city. You've got 30,000 employees or so. You've got hundreds of thousands of children. And that group tends to attract the broken toys. The people that would prey upon those children are attracted to the child that's not watched over, that's not cared for, that seems to be isolated. We know the studies tell us all about this, about sexual predation. For the schools not to take it seriously or to hold back the information until the Tribune threatened to publish. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. they didn't bring the information to our investigative reporters about cases until we had the information.
Right.
Our guys, David Jackson, Gary Marks, mm-hmm. until they had the information. Then they cough it up. And then Miss Janice Jackson,
right.
the CEO, said a remarkable thing, guys. She said, let's keep the politics out of this. You know, as if this, you know, I've got my mama bear, or whatever she said. I'm a mama bear now.
That's what she said.
Now, here's my thing, my interpretation. Politics is all we have. That's what people do when the people want to make their case. When the people want to say what they want to say, they say it in politics. That's how the people respond to machines and information. That's how we respond, by voting, by talking. I think that was an unfortunate and terrible error on the part of Miss Janice Jackson.
Well, if she's a mama bear, then Ron must be her cub, because so far he's the only one she's been protecting. That's her job. Her job is politics. She's not a CEO. CEOs run the district. She doesn't run this district. Her job is to meet with the mayor's office several times a week, memorize her talking points, and then get out there and repeat those talking points to any and everybody who will listen. Her job is politics. Her first response, just for her to insert the word politics into it, is politics. For her to go after the mayor's challenges the way she did, that was politics. She could have left politics out of it, but she chose not to, because her job is politics. And so, you know, and when the district refused to go after, when the district refused to release their stuff to the Trib, she was either the CEO or the chief education officer when this was going down. When the law department went after that little girl in court and tried to discredit her, she was in a leadership position right underneath Forrest Claypool when that was happening. Where was Mama Bear then? You know, Mama Bear was protect. She's right. She was Mama Bear, but she was Mama Bear to Rom. She protects him. You know, I wish somebody out there would create a meme with her as Mama Bear and Rom as Baby Bear, because that's the relationship there.
Scott Stannis, I'm talking to you.
We're going to call Scott Stannis.
I want to see that.
He's gonna draw that cartoon up. So for those of you who don't know, Troy announced early. He was the first person to announce. Then other people came in. An amazing thing happened. There are amazing good candidates in this race, and I'm so happy for that, as opposed to having clowns like when Daley and Rom used to pick clowns to run against them. Now we have real candidates. Troy is one of these. But I've noticed, I've only been doing this, Jeff Carlin, for 300,000 years, I've noticed that there are no Latino candidates in the race, but there are like 7,000 black candidates in the race. Not really 7,000, but you got
I think
the
it's seven. I think you hit you the got, right number.
You
right,
you got the church lady. We have the church lady with her goat farm. We've got, you know, name them, Willie Wilson. He's our friend, but you know, come on, man.
Willie Wilson, Jamal Green, Neil Sales Griffith, Dorothy Brown, myself. I think there's one other.
Lori Lightfoot.
And Lori Lightfoot. Six. All right. That's six black candidates. That's seven.
My theory in Chicago politics is there's no such thing as a coincidence. I don't believe in coincidences when it comes to a $5 billion corporation.
Right. Damn near six.
Six. So I
CPS?
Not counting the debt.
Right.
So what's going on here? Is Rom encouraging these people to run? I know he didn't encourage you.
No, he didn't. Yeah, I can never tell. You know, if you ask me, is Rom capable of doing that? I'd say absolutely. He'll do anything to win an election. That's his nature. You know, he that's one thing. He can't run a city, but he's extremely good at winning elections. And so if you're asking me if he's capable of it, absolutely. If you ask me if I believe that it is highly probable that many of these people are in as a result
of him and his backdoor manipulation? Absolutely. Can I say with certainty? No. But we know who we're dealing with. We know his history. We know what he's capable of, and he's certainly capable of that.
So when will, if the black community, I hate when people say the black community, because that implies that everybody's in the same community.
Right.
And that's not really true, except for politics. But if black Chicago wants a black mayor, I don't know why they would. I don't believe in picking by race at all. I grew up in the days of Dr. King, mm-hmm. and that content of character is what's always important to me. But I understand the politics. If there's no black candidate, if there's no black mayor now, I anticipate there never will be, because Latino politics is such that that's the dynamic move down the road, and that African Americans will be relegated to a second or third place position in terms of power rankings in Chicago. What do you think?
You know, you're talking to a gentleman with an interesting backstory that makes me believe just about anything is possible when it comes to race in Chicago. You know, my mother, who's a white woman, when my oldest brother was born, she was forced to leave her neighborhood. Her mother told her, and she was a teenager at the time, told her that, you know, you can't bring a black child into this neighborhood, so you have to give it up for adoption or leave. And so my mother chose to leave. And 50 years later, as I was going in to my first interview at Blaine Elementary School, tears began to roll down my face, because I realized that I was about to be the next principal of this school. And I realized it because I was heading back into the community that my mother came from. And I thought, 50 years ago, my mother had to leave this community because of the color of her firstborn son. And now 50 years later, another one of her sons is about to be brought back into the community by an all-white local school council and given the most important responsibility you can give someone over the education and safety of their children. I knew I was about to be that principal. Like, this had to happen. And so when you live that life, it's hard to be cynical. When you see that long arc of what's possible, where this city was and where it was for my mother and what it became for me, you know, anything is possible. That people can change, people can grow, that we can get beyond our prejudices. We're certainly not, I don't see that as a story, that one of those stories like when Barack became president, that, you know, race is not an issue anymore, because it certainly is. And I experienced it even when I got to Blaine, I experienced it. But I certainly can't ignore the progress that took place over those 50 years that enabled an all-white local school council to bring someone that they had been taught to be prejudiced, conditioned to be prejudiced. America teaches us all to be prejudiced against one another. We all hold prejudices. But they got over those prejudices and were able to see the talent that I brought and bring it into their community. And we were able to make Blaine the number one neighborhood school in the city as a result. And I think that same kind of growth, that same ability to look beyond our prejudices on a city level is possible. I think it's possible in this election, and I think it could be possible in any election afterwards. You're going to have a compelling candidate with a compelling message, and I think we're going to bring that.
Sure. A lot of people throw up the idea of an elected school board in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And just judging by what you've talked about and how the mayor is controlling whoever the mayor is, but obviously Ron being the mayor currently, appoints people. And they're people who, like you said, that have no business in education or have no background in education. I don't want to assume, but what's your take on an appointed versus an elected school board?
So, in general, I'm for an elected school board, but my position is much more nuanced than the typical position that you hear when people call for one. What we have to understand is that it's not the mayor that controls the school board. It's the mayor and his allies. It's the people behind the mayor. The mayor represents a corporate agenda, right? It's not his agenda. He's the water carrier for that agenda. And whether the mayor has control of the school board or is an elected school board, those interests that paid for the mayor's campaign to get him elected, then those same interests are going to line up
behind every single district that they separate, candidate in every single sub-district that they separate the school district into, and line up behind candidates and put tens of millions of dollars into their campaign so that they can then get control of the school board through those candidates.
Just like if it's open to election, the Chicago's Teachers Union will elect board members of its own.
They'll run people
who's, and this, I'm not against the CTU, I'm just saying what they are. They're representing teachers. They're not representing children. Their main issue, as we see by the Betrayed series, where they send lawyers to, again, like the school, like the CPS did, to discredit victims. So they're gonna, their business is to represent their members, and is that good business to have the union use its organizational abilities to organize and select a school board?
So we have to remember we have a choice in an election, right? And I'll take an organization representing teachers than an organization or a group or a PAC representing corporations any day of the week, because I know those teachers are closer to the students than the corporation or that Republican or right wing or whatever PAC will ever be. We don't choose between perfect and imperfect in elections. We choose between the interests that are running. And if I have to choose between corporate interests and the interests of someone representing corporations and someone representing teachers, I'm going to go with the teachers 19 out of 20 times. You know, I have my issues with CTU.
I go with the parents.
I go, if the parents are running.
I'd want a parents running.
Right. And my guess is the CTU will probably back some parents that are running. Because they certainly have some alliances. You know, Raise Your Hand is a parent organization. And I know they work with the CTU quite a bit when their interests converge. There are times when their interests don't converge.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
If I may switch subjects for a second, we've got we've talked a lot about the education piece, but every candidate, as I've written in the column, every candidate has to convince the people of Chicago and the interests that run it that they can run the city. Mm-hmm. Some of those candidates, I don't think can, particularly the one with, you know, who charged her employees $5 a piece so they could wear jeans and sells non-existent goats, in where the IRS, I'm sure, will find all about those non-existent goats. But others have to make the case.
Right.
So far, I've seen Paul Vallis make that case.
Okay.
I've seen, because I know that he has the experience. I've seen Lori Lightfoot try. I don't know necessarily if, mm-hmm. you know, because she had her issues with, she'd rip on the cops, but stays away from even criticizing any of the union in this Betrayed series. I've seen, I don't know if Willie Wilson can. Can you?
Absolutely.
Can you convince the people that, hey, I'm a principal, I'm an educator, and therefore give me the keys to the city and I'll run it? How do you do that?
Absolutely. I mean, think about the one we have right now, right? People have to ask that question of him because, you know, people go, oh, you're an educator, so how can you, well, what about Ron? Like, he was, his claim to fame is he could raise money for candidates. How does that qualify you to run a city? And so what I say, there are four major areas of skill that you want from your elected officials, particularly one who is an executive elected official and not a legislative elected official. You know, and the mayor is an executive elected official. First, you want them to have a record of responsible management of public money. Right? There are forces lined up to encourage elected officials to manage money irresponsibly. And you want someone who has a record of responsible management of public money. You know, that's a transferable skill. You can take that skill from education to any other area if you've shown that you can do it. I've managed tens of millions of dollars as a principal, not one dime in question, not one dime wasted on pay to play, not one dime wasted on some relative to get a job, not one dime.
Lobsters and steaks.
Right. No lobsters and steaks, steak dinners, not a single dime in question. So I have that record of responsible management of public money. The next thing you want is a record of actually improving public institutions. You go into an institution, and then that institution is better off as a result of you having been in it than it would have been before without you there. And so I came into Blaine. It was already a good school, but when we left Blaine, it was the number one neighborhood school in the city of Chicago because of some very specific things that I can go into detail, but I'm guessing we don't have time. But I have that record of improving public institutions. The third, and I think the third is the most important, because the core problem with government right now is corruption. And if we know the core problem is corruption, what skill do we need? What history, what record do we need from our elected officials to undo that problem? So if the core problem is corruption, it means that we have elected officials who are willing to sacrifice the public good for private gain. And so we have to have a candidate with a record of sacrificing his own personal gain for the public good. And I don't think there's any candidate in this race who can stand up to my record of sacrificing my own personal gain for the public good repeatedly, over and over again, from calling out Barbara Bird Bennett when she was my boss because I couldn't sit idly by when 600 other principals were and watch her steal money from our students. I was the first. We're talking about this Aramark custodial thing a lot in the news right now. This is 2018. You go back to 2014, you will see one name in the paper. Every time you see a story about those custodians, you'll see Troy LaRavier quoted as the principal calling out this corrupt contract. So I have a record of sacrificing my own personal gain for the benefit of the public good. And the last thing we need is a commitment, a candidate who has a commitment to equity. The inequitable distribution or the inequitable treatment of different communities in this city is a huge problem. It is the core of the problem, a lack of investment in the areas that count. And so as principal of Blaine, one of the ways I was able to take it to number one was to look at those inequities in my own school that were there before I got there and address those inequities. And so whether it's responsible management of public money. So, for example, I didn't know if we had the time. I'm so glad you gave me a chance to do this. When I got to Blaine, there was a gifted program, and only one-third of the kids had access to it. Now, Blaine was 60% white, 30% Latino, 5% black, about 5%, the other 10% black and Asian. If you walked into that gifted classroom, you would have thought you were in an all-white school. And so this is the kind of inequity I'm walking into.
What's inequity about that?
That the only kids in the gifted program are pretty much the white kids? That's inequitable.
Because there were standards that were set to get in and others didn't make those standards, or what? Or did we say, too many white kids, so you kids who are white, we'll pull you out of the gifted program to put others in?
So this is what we did. We said, particularly in a neighborhood like Blaine, right? Particularly in a neighborhood like Blaine. So what we said is that we think nearly every kid in this school, because if you have a curriculum gap, which is what this was, you're automatically guaranteeing you're going to have an achievement gap. You've built an achievement gap into the system.
Right.
And so what we said is we think more of our children than just one-third can handle an accelerated curriculum. And so what we began to do is slowly give, instead of taking kids out, we just gave everybody else access. And so today, more than 90% of the kids at Blaine have that curriculum. And what we began to do also is to shift resources, because we knew some of those kids who we began to give access to were going to be challenged by this. And so we hired fully licensed teachers to serve as intervention specialists for these kids as they struggled, some struggled with mastery of this new curriculum. We were pleasantly surprised, by the way, that most did not struggle. Right? Most didn't need intervention. All they needed was someone who believed that they could handle it. But for those who did struggle, we had those intervention specialists in place to help them out. And so we went from 79% of our kids meeting standards, which was the fourth highest in CPS, to 89%, which was the highest in CPS for neighborhood schools.
And you got fired anyway.
And I got fired anyway. But that's a commitment. So we became excellent because of a commitment to equity. Because
the kids who were not performing up to standard, it wasn't because they couldn't. It was because the system was so inequitable, it wouldn't even challenge them and give them the resources to rise. And so we began to shift resources to them, and it didn't hurt the kids who were already meeting standards. They rose too. Equity, an equitable approach to running public institutions helps everyone. And it eventually, that equity focus made Blaine the number one neighborhood school in the city. And I think an equity focus across this city will do the same thing for Chicago.
Well, to make a clumsy transition out of that.
Sure.
I'd like the whole political system to be equitable. And as a result, I would like to see where the hell are the Latino candidates for mayor? Mm-hmm. Why do you think there are no Latino candidates for mayor? Do you think it's because Chewy and the heroic taxpayer who paid $275 for his $350,000 house in taxes and tells everybody what to do, is it a deal with them? And Rahm, is Rahm the Latino candidate now that he's, you know, Zorro, Mayor Zorro of the Sanctuary Cities? There's something else going on. Why? Where's the Latino candidate?
So I think we have to remember that, I mean, there was no Latino candidate for quite a while the last round. And in fact, we had no intention of running. It was Rahm, it was Karen Lewis, and the gentleman who runs for mayor every cycle, I forget his name. And it was only at Karen Lewis's, and it's interesting, it was only at the encouragement of a black former candidate that the Latino candidate stepped out. Karen Lewis, a black woman, encouraging a Latino candidate to run for mayor. I think there's a lot, there's something, whatever you think about Karen and Chewy, there's something beautiful about that. There's something that says there's still some alliances, there's still a chance, there's some unity between black and Latino political forces that, you know, can serve this city well. That said, I don't think I can answer like why there's an absence. The fact that existing powers within the Latino American community are not putting one up, I think that's what you're alluding to in terms of there is a power base in the Latino community. It just got 5 people elected to public office, but for some reason that network is not putting the candidate up for mayor. I couldn't tell you why. The other thing I have to say is I don't think that is as important as making sure we get a mayor who is grounded in working people and putting an agenda together for working people. So, for example, the last time around, I wasn't concerned with the fact that there weren't a whole bunch of black candidates. I was concerned with the fact that we had a candidate that was grounded in working people, and Chewy was the candidate. So I didn't go off looking for a black candidate. I said, we have an option here.
Yeah.
His name is Chewy Garcia. He has a record of fighting for working people. He has a record of giving a damn about equity. I'm going to back this candidate. That was far more important to me than getting a black candidate in, making sure we had one that was going to represent the interests of working people.
That makes sense. Troy, thanks for being here.
Thanks, John.
Appreciate it.
I'm glad we were able to do it, and I feel honored that I am the last interview.
In your time
here at the Tribune Tower.
This is where all the work is done. Actually, it's done on my deck when I talk to Jeff. I'm having a cigarette. I'm talking to Jeff on the deck. What's up? What's up? We talk, you know. Anyway, for everybody who listened to this maudlin broadcast where I start crying my eyes out and reaching for the Irish whiskey, I want to thank everybody who listened, who showed up at the Tribune Lit, at the Printer's Row Lit Fest. Of course, Jeff Carlin, WGN producer of the Rokon Show with Anna Devalanis, and Troy LaRavier, who's a candidate for mayor and the first, who's just called on the school board to resign. That might make a column. Who knows? My name is John Cass, your mild-mannered, nationally syndicated father, husband, newspaper guy, and this has been The Chicago Way.